In this week's program, another book from the music critic of The New Yorker, Alex Ross. This is a collection of essays about classical music, jazz, pop and rock, but mainly about the classical variety. In the book's title essay, Listen to This, the author mounts a convincing onslaught on the kind of snobbery that he believes pervades the world of classical music, the kind that sees it as inherently superior to other forms. He argues that the arrival of the Beatles and Dylan in the 1960s challenged classical music's claim on high art. In that decade, the sales of classical music dropped from 20% to 5%. Today, it occupies no more than 2% of the market, the same figure as jazz. With me, Ethna Tinney, who's a musician, and Ronan Guilfoyle, who's a jazz composer and musician. He says, "I hate classical music, Ethna, not the thing but the name." There are other names like art music, serious music, good music. How are you with the name itself?
Very difficult. I mean, it's one thing I agree with Alex Ross, because to me, classical also means a certain 100 years of music. Mm-hmm. So when we say classical music, you're thinking of Haydn and Mozart, you know, and Baroque is before that and Romantic is after that. So it's a misnomer, and it has been appropriated to signify music of high artistic quality that survives. And this is one of the key points down through centuries. I will allow the word classical music, but I have a difficulty with the word,
How do you find the term itself, Ronan?
Classical? Well, I understand both of those. I mean, people refer to classical music with a very broad brush, the same way as they do jazz is a very broad brush. I mean, jazz is 100 years old now. It's got a myriad of styles, and people say the word jazz, and that can mean anything from Louis Armstrong to music that's based on electronics. And so I understand also the classical. It's the same thing. People use the word classical to have a handy catch-all phrase for something that they imagine, you know, what that is. They have an imagination themselves of what that is. And it's like, it's very difficult for, because you have in classical music, to use the word in its broad sense, you have contemporary composers, and usually the word contemporary frightens the life out of audiences. Yet the idea of that, all of the people that they revere as being classical composers were in their own day contemporary composers. So, on the one hand, the label is silly. On the other hand, words have power, you know, and they can do damage as well.
I think the problem, though, is not so much with classical music as when it's used interchangeably with serious music or good music, when people are giving to suggest, you know, that that's what good or serious music is. It's confined to classical music. That's the kind of suggestion, isn't it, at times, Ethna?
Well, I suppose you could break it down into components, like, for example, that classical music is written by composers who have bothered to learn notation, for starters, who are very proficient at an instrument. I mean, if you think of Beethoven or Brahms, or, you know, so many of them were great pianists. And then, of course, Mozart was a pretty neat fiddle player as well. But Ronan would make the same case probably for jazz musicians in terms of their abilities as instrumentalists. But it's a different tradition in that, well, first of all, it's very improvisatory. But second of all, it's not written down. And I think part of the arcane sense of music is notated music. If you don't understand how to read music, musical notation, then it's a closed book to you.
I'm talking about the sense, you know, about what might give offence. And what might give offence is when the term classical music is meant to suggest that's good music or serious music. Other kind of music isn't.
Yeah, that's true. There was a book written by Henry Pleasance in the 1950s called Serious Music and All That Jazz, in which he kind of, it's a very good book, and in which he was a classical music critic who became converted to the idea that he now considered, at that point, jazz to be a more serious music than what was going on in classical music at that time. It's a very provocative book, but it's a great title anyway. And one thing that he resented, and of course he had the zeal of the convert as well, because he was a classical music critic, was the idea of the abrogation of the term, or the taking of the term serious music by classical, you know, people in the classical world to designate their music and separate it from other kinds of music. Whereas, of course, anybody who's really serious about their music is producing serious music if they're really serious about it, you know, and if they have a serious intent to communicate something through music, they are by definition serious. And, of course, you know, the thing, to go back to that thing that words have power, you know, the idea that somebody is a, as a jazz musician, I can tell you I've had many, many instances of talking to people who have certain preconceived ideas about what I do simply by adding the word jazz onto what I do, that it's somehow less, you know, it's kind of a bit of fun, it's letting your hair down and that's it, you know, that it's that kind of thing, as opposed to playing serious music, you know, which you would do if you were playing classical music. And since I operate in both worlds in a way, and since I work with classical musicians, I work with jazz musicians, I can say that they're equally serious. Both worlds are equally serious. Mm. And I know other worlds that are equally serious too, like Indian classical music, for example. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I would consider Ravi Shankar to be a very serious musician, for example, great virtuoso, but he doesn't deal with notated music. So, you know, it's the idea that serious is confined to one sure. tradition is not a very good.
What about the point as to marketing, Ethna? His point that it's been marketed as a luxury product, classical music, that is, one that replaces, he's saying, an inferior popular product. The whole idea, the suggestion is it's a luxury product.
In view of what Rowan has just said, I just answer that slightly elliptically. What's very interesting to me about this book is that this case has been made before.
Sure.
Everything to do with it, the snobbery, the elitism and so on, and has been turned on its head. And very interestingly, the opening chapter actually quotes many people who have been provocative on this subject before. So in a sense, Ross almost undermines the purpose of that essay. But he refers in that essay to being going to lectures by Ligeti when he was, you know, a couple of decades ago. And he refers to them as dazzlingly erudite. But the thing about this book is that it is also dazzlingly erudite. And isn't that what Ross wants to be? And he's a bit of a name dropper because, you know, he quotes so many other critics. I don't know how he's found the time to read them all. On one page alone, there are five people referred to. So when you come to his notions about marketing music, I do think that Ross himself has an intellectual elitism. All right? So that's the way he's going to perceive music, whether we call it Beethoven's music, let's just call it Beethoven's music, and the way that it is sold. I think that, look, you cannot avoid the stark reality that very few people buy Beethoven symphonies anymore compared with Bjork or Beyoncé or whatever.
By the way, how unusual is he? And he says he listened to nothing but classical music until the age of 20. How unusual is that?
Yeah. It's very unusual, and because I consider my own experience to be very unusual in that I just listened to classical music and jazz till I was about 14, which is very unusual in itself, and that my father was completely a maniac on these musics, particularly classical music from 1880 onwards and jazz from 1945 onwards. So I was raised on a mixture of Bartok, Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Stravinsky, Charles Mingus, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker. He didn't listen to any 19th century music. He didn't listen to any jazz before 1945. So I was raised in this very modernist household. And I didn't really hear pop music till I was 14 when we went on holidays to Skerries and they had a jukebox in the corner. And suddenly I was hearing this other music. So to me, when I look back and I realise how extraordinary a childhood that was. However, that was Ireland in the 1960s, and I think with Alex Ross we're talking about probably America in the 1970s when there was much greater spreading of music through media, and it was you know, a decade later. So I think his thing is very unusual.
And how about you, Ethna? I mean, what did you grow up with then?
I suppose really, you know, since my mother played the piano and quite well from the earliest age, I was listening to Beethoven sonatas, you know, and a lot else besides Chopin and so on. But we also had a housekeeper, Kathleen, who was mad into the latest pop. And she had a little, you know, one of these little 45 thingies and you know, we'd hear the latest Dickie Rock and whatever. And you know, so we heard both sides.
So you heard everything.
Absolutely, yeah. We did, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the radio too, at breakfast time.
And what was the first piece that really, the first classical piece that drew you to it?
I can't say that.
Yeah.
There's far too much in there. I wouldn't remember anything particular.
For him, and for you, was there a particular piece?
In classical music, I would say The Rite of Spring, and which we were never told was a very difficult piece of music. It was just music we heard all the time. Because my father had speakers in all the downstairs rooms of the house, so whenever he put on a record or turned the radio on, you couldn't get away from it. So you would be literally blasted with this music, you know, whenever he was listening to it. And the other one would be, the one I remember particularly, there were several, but the jazz one would be Charles Mingus, Blues and Roots, and particularly a track in there called Wednesday Night Prayer Meeting.
¶¶ Charles Mingus in Wednesday night prayer meeting. I recall John Montague, in his memoir, I think, writing about meeting him in California in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, he was a titanic figure. I mean, literally, figuratively, big guy and very, very emotional person. That's, you know, kind of wild character. But I remember when I was 11 years of age, this is the first piece that I can remember independently going to my father's record collection and taking out this record and putting it on when he wasn't there. I was about 11 years of age, and we had a stereogram, which, you know, when you think of the iPod now, you're holding the palm of your hand, this was a monstrous, like a sideboard.
Yeah.
And you had speakers on each side of you, and I sat with my back to the stereo. I turned the knob up to 11. Nobody was in, I think. And I sat there, and I put on Wednesday night prayer meeting. I had this thing blasted out at me. And I have tremendous memory of that and the hair in the back of my neck standing up. I'd never really experienced the visceral nature of music like that before. Mm. I mean, and that to me is my first memory of independently going to look for a piece of music to listen to that wasn't put on by my parents or by my father.
And Ethna, what are you putting on, stealthily or otherwise?
Well, I want to make a point about Alex Ross, and we might come back to this afterwards. It's very hard to put your finger on precisely what he is. He tells us that he studied the piano, but he was no good. And yet he makes this extraordinary claim at one point that he sight-read his way through the first movement of the Schubert last B-flat sonata. You cannot do that unless you're Sviatoslav Richter, I assure you. So to actually put your finger on what is Alex Ross. Now, this is the way Alex Ross writes about music, and I have a difficulty with it. This is an example. He doesn't do this now. I'm doing him.
This is a pastiche.
And then I'll say how I would introduce the music, okay? And then we'll hear it. The close of Shostakovich's Piano Concerto in C is perhaps the greatest iconoclastic moment in 20th century music. The trumpet, that most ancient instrument of all, reaching back millennia in the civilization of humankind, is locked to the death in a struggle with the 19th century upstart piano, and with a relentless ostinato on the third of the scale, superbly overcomes the pretensions of its rival. Okay, that's Alex Ross speaking. Now, this is Ethna Tinney. The end of Shostakovich's first piano concerto is absolutely hilarious. The trumpet attempts to take over proceedings with a vulgar circus-like tune. The piano retaliates with increasingly hysterical volleys of virtuosity, to which the trumpet responds with a succession of repeated E's, like a cheeky schoolboy blowing raspberries at his teachers from a safe distance.
Ethna, you've outclassed him. You've outclassed him beyond a shadow of a doubt. So you both have the piece that you're going to introduce for us is the end of the Shostakovich first piano concerto, the third movement.
Correct.
Talk to us about it in terms other than the exquisite ones you've just used.
Well, I mean, that was the point, that you listen to it now and decide, isn't that all a load of rubbish? Let's hear it.
Thank you. The ending of the third movement of Shostakovich's first piano concerto. Excellent choice. Excellent choice. When did you first hear it?
Oh, goodness, I've known it for years and years and years. I think my brother Hugh has played it, so I probably heard him practicing it as well. I know it well.
Sure you did.
But it's just a great piece of music. And I suppose my point is, why do you have to hyperbolize it, you know?
Give him a break. Give Mr. Ross a break. Right. Tell me, how do you think he deals with jazz overall? We were talking about the way he's out to subvert all hierarchies that put classical music at the top. How does he treat jazz?
Well, he doesn't mention it very much at all, actually, quite frankly. It's much more focused on pop music as the other music in it. There's a couple of mentions of it, but very little, actually. It's mostly in passing. I get the feeling that he's not terribly conversant with jazz. I also got that feeling from The Rest Is Noise.
The other book,
he does mention jazz in it a little bit, but it's very, very minor. I get the feeling he's not terribly interested. He is... possibly more interest in pop music, and he certainly writes about pop music in this one. But what struck me about the funny thing about the way he writes about pop music for me is that he's talking about at the very beginning that he hates this idea of classical music and hierarchies and all that, and yet his writing about pop music, with the exclusion of the chapter on Dylan, is nearly always trying to show the kind of classical qualities of the people he's writing about.
He keeps harping on about
look the way he's gone from F major to A major, and one of the guys went to music school, and one guy studied composition for 2 years. And
the Radiohead chapter, I was very struck when he's talking about the brother that plays the Aunt Martineau, because then he makes this extraordinary claim: fewer than 100 people have mastered it. How does he know? For God's sake,
But he's and again with Bjork, he keeps talking about how she liked Stockhausen and all of that kind of thing. So he's constantly trying to bring.
So you're saying there's an implicit hierarchy there.
Absolutely. Right. He's showing that the pop music is good by virtue of the fact that it has qualities that you can find in classical music.
He's very good on Dylan. The question is, how accurate is he? For example, much has been written by critics like Christopher Ricks, doing a high-level formal analysis of the lyrics that Dylan wrote. And here is our friend saying, no, that in fact those lyrics only occur at the beginning of the pieces and they're carried by the music. It's the music that really carries the piece.
I cannot take Dylan in any shape or form. I've never been able to. I have many friends that are who's great musicians whom I respect very much, who love him. So I'm prepared to admit that maybe it's me. And you know, before coming on the program, I went into Alex Ross's the online stuff to accompany the book, which I think is a great idea. And I had a go at the Dylan, but I couldn't. I managed everything else, but I liked some things, but I really can't. I just cannot take the singing.
How about you, Esther?
I have never taken to Bob Dylan, and I would have to say that, I mean, I wouldn't even speak about it. You know, there are certain pockets of music that I have never gone towards, and Bob Dylan
Three
is one of
us
them.
In one room, I'm ashamed. I'm actually ashamed. I wouldn't have the courage to admit it, but there you are, three of us together. Because one thing, he talks a lot about musical education, and he says the real problems today, the teachers are trained in the conservatory, who are trained in the conservatory, are too preoccupied with technique. There's no discussion of music's social, political or spiritual meaning. Is he right there?
I think he has a strong point there. And I mean, there are many strong points in this book, and I recommend this book. And if you find some of the writing tedious, just skip over it. And certainly I would agree with Alex Ross. The thing that I would emphasise is, and he touches on this at another time, is that we have lost the ability to improvise, those of us in the classical tradition, if I may use that word. Obviously, jazz is based on improvisation, so it has never been lost there. And I always found it personally a disability.
You have it in cadenzas, don't you? I mean,
rarely. You generally use, if Mozart hadn't written one, or Beethoven, you'd use one by Alfred Brendel or Erwin Fischer or whatever. I attempted once to play my own cadenza in Beethoven's second piano concerto, although he's written a very extensive one himself, and I was ashamed of it. So I reverted to the Beethoven. It's a real disability. So whatever about introducing political ideas and social ideas, which I think is it would be fantastic. But where would you find a music teacher that could do all of that?
Well, the point is, then, what does that say about the conservatory? What do you make of this?
I think things are changing. There's a lot of what they call, there's a great name for it in America now, they call it in the cracks music, which is music that is kind of hard to tell whether it's classical or jazz. And there's a lot of stuff going on. For example, I've been involved occasionally in a thing called Renga in London with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, which is an in-orchestra training scheme, a voluntary one, in which the orchestra, members of the orchestra, work with people from outside their own tradition. I've gone over there and done a couple of things with some players from the LPO. And there are things I thought going on in the United States as well. I think it's a great idea. And you're starting to see hybrid degrees appearing, which people use elements from both jazz education, which is also in the academy now, has been for about 30 years, and classical ones. And I think that things are changing. I think one of the reasons is sheer it's practicality, because you're much more employable if you've got a wider range of skills than if you can only play in an orchestra, because the orchestral jobs are so scarce. Whereas if you can go through a very high level conservatoire training for 15 years and come out and not be able to get a job. Whereas if somebody comes through the jazz education system, they may not work as a jazz musician, but they're also capable of working in many other situations because they are much more versatile, because they can improvise, because they have good technique, because they can read, they do all of these things well. So even if they can't get a job as a jazz musician, they can apply for jobs in other areas, whereas classical music is so specialised that if you can't get a job in a classical orchestra, you're almost unemployable outside that.
Is he right in saying that the iPod has liberated generations from the current generation from rigid hierarchies, that if you have to listen to one kind of music after another is all there on your iPod, then you're less likely to think of one as inherently superior to another?
I have no idea, because I do not iPod. End of story. And I never will. This idea of going around with your ears closed.
Is that out of philosophical conviction?
It's a complete philosophical conviction. I am going to be a Luddite and stick with my CDs so that I make a choice of what I want to listen to. Most importantly, that you're not closed off in your own mind, having these things stuck in your ears.
Yeah. How about Ronan?
I'm not quite so sure that I think there's a mistake implicit in both what Alex Ross says and what Ethan says, in the sense that music doesn't appear on your iPod. You actually have to download it. So you are actually making a decision whether it's a CD or not. And I think his idea that, you know, the iPod's going to change everything, I don't think that that's true either, because the people with the iPod have to make a decision to download a classical piece along with their punk music, along with their jazz. And they're just about as unlikely to do that now as they ever were, you know. So I think the idea that the iPod is a great democratizer is not true either. You actually have to make a decision to download a piece of music onto your iPod. So therefore, you have to want to listen to it in the first place. So I'm not quite so sure that that's the case.
What about this new category that he's invented? The people who know about classical music but don't go to concerts. He calls them culturally aware non-attenders.
Yeah, that's a very interesting one.
Isn't it? Is there a new breed that, you know, are very well up on classical music, simply don't go to concerts?
Well, they wouldn't be that new. Because even when I was in Trinity, for example, you had people who wouldn't deign to go to concerts. Yeah. And there were many such.
Ross is suggesting, though, it's something kind of new.
I also think that's tied in with another thing, which is a much bigger discussion, which is the idea that people don't feel they should pay for music anymore, in that they download music for free, they listen, they have so much music available, and that the idea of actually putting their hand in their pocket and paying €20 or $20 or $25, whatever it is, to go to a concert, they're much more reluctant to do that now than they ever were. I'm not quite so sure if that's true in the classical world. I don't know. Certainly in the jazz world, anecdotally, among my friends, among colleagues, you have the idea that they don't want to do this. I did a workshop in a university last year with a group that I was touring with. There were 60 kids at the workshop. We had a great time. They loved it. And not one of them came to the concert that night. Not one of them.
We've been discussing Listen to This by Alex Ross, published by Fourth Estate. My thanks to Ronan Guilfoyle and Ethna Tinney. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.